Well, Gary, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. We're at opposite sides of the world, 8 o'clock at night for me, 4 in the morning for you, and we're doing a Bitcoin podcast. I mean, really, what better way to start the day or finish the day?
Absolutely.
Well, Gary, where I want to start, and it's something I've really started leaning into recently, is the question, like, what do you do, is the most boring question in the whole world. But the question, what are you working on that is most exciting, opens up avenues to all the coolest stuff. So that's where I want to kick off today. What are you most excited about that you're working on at the moment?
Okay. Yeah, I'll slight tangent before then. I always like to
Please.
ask, what is your life about? And that always catches people off guard because a lot of people don't seem to know how to answer that question, but I leave it intentionally vague and open so that way they can guide the conversation, right? Because if you don't want to tell me about your
Yes.
personal life, your professional life, whatever, I like to go, well, what's your life about? And sometimes people just launch right into it, but more often than not, people are taken aback and they're like, what do you mean? You know what I mean? It's like somebody's never asked them such a profound and open-ended question.
And also it's difficult to answer because often we go through every day almost in a form of autopilot. We haven't sat down and thought, well, what is my vision? What is the future version of me that I want to become? What are the things I want to achieve in my life that are non-negotiables? And it's actually that's true personal development work that weirdly, actually, sound money and Bitcoin has enabled me to start asking some of those questions that before, when you're on that rabbit wheel, you don't have time to get up and breathe, So, well, maybe I'll start by asking you that, Gary, given that I'm hosting the conversation. So, what was the question? What's your life about? Is
What
that
is
what you
your life
said?
about?
Yeah, okay, Gary, what is your life about?
I mean, lately it's been about growing closer to Jesus and raising a family. And
Awesome.
that's really been the biggest part of it. And Bitcoin's just one small enabler of giving me the time, giving my time back from the time thieves, right? To do that.
Wow. Okay. And so to answer that question for myself, a lens on the world that I'm trying to develop a lot more of is, so I come at a lot of all of this Bitcoin conversation from a wealth management perspective. And you may have, if you've heard me on any other podcast, talk about this, but sadly, my father died when I was 20 and he was a wealthy guy. And so in my mid-20s, as the eldest son, I found myself managing an inheritance. It's like, what do you do with this stuff? Don't fuck it up, being the number one thing, but it's very financially focused. It's like it's numbers, it's investments, it's like return on investment. And what I've just started to think through a lot more of is actually the different forms of capital that exist, of which financial capital is just one. And I like to frame it as humanistic capital. So the investment you make in your partner, the investment that you make in having children, the investment you make in the relationships that you have, the space that you create for them to grow and become who they want to be is very difficult to quantify financially, but is a classic humanistic investment. So my life today is actually predominantly homeschooling kids. So if I had to have a job title, my work is my job as a dad, which I do every day. And it's only at 8 o'clock at night that I jump online and have more creative pursuits like this. And Bitcoin has enabled that in many ways. So definitely, let's talk about that and family. So Gary, so why did you start a family?
I mean, I met, the love of my life, and it was at the time I didn't think too much about it. It was just kind of one of those things that you did, right? It's like, oh, you get married and then you end up having kids and everything. And I knew I wanted to have like a lot of kids, and we're only at three. And we'll see how high we go. But the starting the family it wasn't very intentional. I don't think, like, I knew that was a thing that you're supposed to do, and I was excited to have kids and everything. But I never really stopped and asked myself why. And honestly, I don't think I had the time or the luxury to even think about it prior to Bitcoin, right? It was just like, hey, we're gonna have kids, we're gonna get married, and I thank God I did. It was best decision of my life. And now we have three at this time. But Yeah, starting it wasn't, I don't think I gave it much intentional thought.
I also have three kids, Gary. So they're currently 5, 3, and 1. And I agree with you that there might be more, which is not something that I was necessarily setting out to do. But you get this far along, you're like, well, what an incredibly enriching experience. And all the cliches are so true. You know, the first moment you hold that child, you're like, I think I get it now. Like, all I have to do is make sure this thing's okay. And as a man, it like really drops in as like, aha, protect. You know what I mean? Like,
And I don't think it sets in quite as immediate for us. I mean, we're not growing a child inside of us. So, you know, the wives definitely get that like feeling in their nesting and all this other stuff. But yeah, truly until, and I remember my good friend, told me, he's like, yeah, you won't get it until you hold your kid. And he's absolutely right. There was not a connection or there wasn't like this gravity of, what was happening until I'm holding my firstborn and she's sitting there in my arms and I'm just like, partially freaking out, but partially, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a flip switched of like, there's a tangible feeling of love and of like a connection to this little human that you just helped bring into this world. And that was a powerful thing, right? It was one of the reasons I left the military service was because we had our first kid and I was like, I'm not going to be gone. I'm done risking my life for whatever this military thing was.
Wow. Yeah. That's actually quite a profound moment, isn't it? Just take me to that then. So what were you doing at the time? And it sounds pretty obvious, like don't risk your life. Now you have another life to care for, or I don't know. Talk me through what happened then.
Yeah, we had our first. I was serving in the U.S. Navy, working in special operations stuff, doing intelligence and everything. And I was just gone a lot, right? It was a lot of training, a lot of exercises, deployments, right? So even when you're back home, you're still gone because you're going to some new training facility to do some new whiz bang training. And once I had the first, and I'm holding her, and I'm realizing that if I'm not around, then like, who is going to do the protecting? Who is going to do the caring? You know, who's going to support my wife and child? And then just on top of that, me being gone, doing not the, we call them high risk evolutions. So it's like, you know, planes and helicopters and all, you know, guns and all that kind of stuff, was just a riskier life. And, now that I did have this other human being that was totally incapable of caring for herself, it was like, I felt a strong compulsion to make sure that everything and anything that this little person needed was ever taken care of. And I realized that there was too much of myself that I was giving to the military. And it wasn't going to work. Like, I wasn't going to be able to do it right. If I had to deploy, if I had to keep doing these trainings and keep, you know, disappearing for months on time. It just didn't feel like the right thing to be done. And I tried to get like a desk job in the Navy and that didn't really work out. They tried to take us to Hawaii, well away from family. That was another no go for us.
It's very interesting. So essentially the trade-offs shifted quickly and you're like, this doesn't make sense for any longer. And was it quite easy to transition out of the military? It was just a case of like, here's my resignation, I'm off in 2 weeks' time.
No. So in the U.S. military, you sign up for a contract. So I had about 2 years left on my contract when my first daughter was born, and you have to like you're owned, right? The government owns you. Like you go where they say, you know, you put on the suit that they dictate and all this other stuff. It's, you know, it's very involved and that's by design, right? You're part of this military unit first and foremost. And so, it was about 2 years where I knew I was getting out and, you know, they do have like a year and a half in advance. They start like shopping you around to see like, where's your next duty station? Because the military was a 3-year tour. So you would, most of the time it was a 3-year tour. So every 3 years you'd be moving somebody else, moving somewhere else. And about a year out, you would figure out like where you're going to go. And so to say it, you know, it was easy. It wasn't like a 2-week resignation or anything. It was more of like, hey, I'm going to do this thing. And then along the way, you know, you get the guilt trips from some of the guys that are staying in for life. And you get some people trying to dangle some carrots in front of you to stick around. But to say it was easy, it was definitely not easy. There's not a lot of setting up for success that the military does. You go from this world where you have to wear the same thing over and over, right? Like your uniform. I woke up every day. I knew what I was going to wear, right? I didn't have to think about that. And then it's even easier on deployment because you're there to do your job and that's it. So you like do your job, you work out, you go to sleep and you just kind of rinse and repeat. The food's there provided for you. Your schedule is largely structured and stuff. So I went from this very, very finite state of like, this is the plan. This is the path. There's not too many branches, to having zero idea of what was going to happen, how it was going to happen, and coming to the realization that I could do literally whatever I wanted, and nobody's going to tell me otherwise, which is both a liberating feeling and a terrifying feeling, because especially with a young family, my wife was pregnant with our second as we were getting out of the Navy, and so this feeling of like I could go do anything. Luckily, I think I made the right choice. I started getting into like software development. And, you know, again, I was aiming for that high paying white collar desk job. And that worked out. But up until a point, you're kind of, what company do I go work for? What, you know, where are we going to live? Like all these things now where there was like an infinite amount of possibilities for us. And so having for the first time to really in my adult life have to like think about second, third order consequences for my decisions. It was, I think I did it right, but yeah, it was a little hairy, very stressful. We moved a lot. You know, we had a house where we were stationed down in Virginia Beach. So we sold the house, moved into an apartment. We were in the apartment for about a year, moved out of that, moved into another house that was a rental. We were only there for 4 months, moved from there to another house that was another rental. So it's just like a very, very, transient and tumultuous period. My oldest daughter moved 4 times in the first 3 years of her life. So like just lots of churn and not, no consistency at all. But
yeah, it's intense, isn't it?
Yeah, it was quite intense, but luckily I'm not going anywhere. I planted my flag firmly in the Northern Shenandoah Valley, and they're going to have to deal with me one way or another.
Cool. The planting the flag process is important. I'm just going through that myself. I worked out the other day when we left an Airbnb, in the last 3 years, we've moved 17 times. My eldest is now 5. And it's just like, you know, that's from one long-term rental contract to then a bunch of short-term ones to then go on a holiday for a bit. And what we've done is gone really aggressive on the Bitcoin adoption in favor of not owning physical real estate, which worked very nicely financially, but I learned a lot of lessons about, you know, providing for a family, providing a space, and I didn't control it. And yes, you can get into the discussion around, you know, physical property rights and whether or not you actually own anything. Self-custody, but it's still, you know, having title in your name is better than a long-term lease. And that's been a real benefit that we're just stepping into now. We're doing some renovations on a place. I'm very excited to be like, look, you can unpack your stuff in there and we're not going anywhere. For me, that's in Melbourne, where my wife's family are from. I'm originally from the UK, but I've emigrated 2 or 3 times now, actually. So I know the feeling of going from different places. It's very exciting on the one hand, but also like, just so much change.
Yeah, and it sounds like it was by choice, right? You knew that you were going to be in this transient state. You know, it's kind of...
That was by choice, yeah.
Our situation is a bit different because it was just like whatever job I could land was sort of the deal. We didn't have much say in where we ended up. I mean, we knew directionally where we wanted to go, but it was kind of like, hey, I'm the only one working. And so whatever job I get, that's where we're going. And it was fine.
Gotta go there.
It ended up well.
And so, Gary, yeah, well done. I don't know how much you are able to discuss per se, but I'm very interested in your military experience. And as part of researching for this podcast episode, listen to some of the podcasts that you shared with me. And I just, it's infinitely fascinating that there are people out there that joined a military organization in the, what's the right word, with a mindset of like fighting for freedom, go in and pick up all of these different competencies that are required to like physically do stuff. Now, whether or not you were more technical or not, you're, you know, extraordinarily talented engineers, for example, like figuring shit out in hostile places, like very, very different to what I've done with my life. And now transitioning out of that world, and I was listening to you guys on the Bitcoin Veterans podcast talking about actually this is the mission. Bitcoin is the mission. And I think that's really fascinating. I'd love to understand, like, what were firstly your major reasons for joining the military in the first instance? And the second part of the question would be like, what were some of the main things you learned whilst you were there?
Yeah, the I mean, joining the military, growing. I graduated in 08 from high school and immediately went into the military. I signed up even when I was 17. Cause I knew that was kind of the path forward. I was not a great student, so college was never a choice. No, university was not like an option. It wasn't that I didn't have the grades. It was just like my demeanor was not fit for that. Played all the Call of Duty games, right? Halo. So, you know, very much grew up like thinking that guns and like shooting people was a cool thing. You know, was sort of successfully, we'll call it psyoped into thinking that this military apparatus in the U.S. military was, you know, spreading freedom and democracy. That was, I remember, I think at the time it was like the Navy was like, accelerate your life was like the catchphrase or the motto. And there was all kinds of cool,
that kind of like ad spiel.
Yeah, it was like their one-liner. I don't remember what the Marines was one, but it was very good. It was very catchy for young men. It was still at the height of Iraq and in Afghanistan, even in 08. You know, as we know, those wars went on forever. But it was an option. And then one of my best friends in high school signed up, and the recruiter was a really good used car salesman, like they usually are. And I was like, oh, I'll do this. And I knew from talking with some friends' parents, it's like, oh, you could do 20 years in the Navy and then you get out and you have this thing, you have a pension, right? Like there was this promise of, oh, you just do 20 years, I'll be 38 and I'll retire with a full pension and I'll get a paycheck, you know, for every month for the rest of my life. Just being sort of naive, not understanding where that pension money is coming from or any implications of a massive welfare program for military members. But yeah, that's kind of why I joined. I did feel, you know, sort of duty bound, sort of honor bound. Like it was this noble cause that I was signing up for. You know, you raise your right hand, you have an oath of enlistment where you pledge to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign, domestic. And it does read like an ethos of something that is worthwhile in a noble cause. And you don't really find out until much later that it's this perverse incentive structure. The military really had become a tool for these perverse incentives, right? It became a tool for money printing. It became a reason to print money. And, you know, that's setting aside the fact that, you know, the weapons of mass destruction weren't actually in Iraq. And like, there was an opportunity to do what we were supposed to do in Afghanistan and take down bin Laden, but like somebody called it off at the last minute. And you just start to see all these malincentives, all the contracting companies, and they're just making gobs and gobs of money doing similar or even less jobs than what like the service members are doing. And over time, I joined very, very starry-eyed and ready to go. Little did I know that like in 08, the world was blowing up, like the economy was blowing up. And I was working a construction job for the summer before I shipped out to boot camp. So I had zero idea about like the 08 crisis or anything like that. It was completely off my radar. But I do remember now in hindsight that there were a lot of older gentlemen in boot camp with me, and they were like previous career kind of guys. Like the one guy was like, yeah, I was like a construction, and like just people that had had previous careers. And in hindsight, like they lost, probably lost their shirt in 08, or for whatever reason, and had to saw this opportunity to go into the military as a way to, you know, make ends meet because government's always hiring.
And so, Gary, when you were in, I can feel that trajectory in terms of like the slow softening of those kind of starry eyes at the start.
Yeah.
Before we really dig into the details of that arc, like what was the area of your speciality? Like, what did you get trained in, or are you constantly being moved around to different departments? And you were in the military for 10 years or something in the end, were you?
Yeah, 11 years, 4 months, and 3 days. The first two of which I spent at the Defense Language Institute, where I learned Chinese Mandarin. So that was like my job. And again, I was signed up to like go be a Navy SEAL and all this other stuff. And turns out I'm colorblind. And so you can't do a lot of jobs in the Navy if you're colorblind. It disqualifies you, except for a very, very small select few jobs. And one of those jobs was a cryptographic linguist, or a cryptographic technician is what the official title was. Wow. And the reason I picked that is they were like, hey, if you take this like language test and you show an aptitude for language, we'll give you a $16,000 bonus. And I was like, that's awesome. Let's do that. And pass the test, you know, qualified and everything, and signed up for it. And I remember asking the guy too, like, hey, so what am I going to do? And he's like, I don't know. It's all top secret. I can't tell you. It is all top secret, but like, it's really boring stuff. You know, I would listen to static and sometimes there was like Chinese in there. Yeah, the job, he just had no idea, 'cause it was not like within his realm. But yeah, I was a Chinese linguist by trade. So I did 2 years of language school, in Monterey, California before going on to Hawaii.
And so then you're spending your days, I mean, you already mentioned that the structure, the uniform, sleeping at certain times, but just listening into different radio stations, trying to catch some Chinese information from somewhere. I mean, what does that manifest as a kind of day-to-day?
Yeah. As a day-to-day, so signals intelligence, you can go look up this term. It's like not a classified term or anything. Okay. But signals, or SIGINT, was like the speciality. And then as a linguist, it was anything that was intercepted, any signals intercepted that needed translating. You know, that's kind of felt to myself and my fellow linguists. So if you go dig around on the internet to see what signals intelligence entails, you can somewhat get an idea. But essentially it was, hey, here's this recording, or here's this clip. There may or may not be some Chinese in there. Just kind of depended on like the source of the intelligence, and my job was to translate it. And it was very rote. Like there was some, you know, some creative thinking needed to it, but for the most part, when you're like a low level person, it's just like, hey, here's this clip, go translate it, and then here's the report format that we wanted in. Let us, you know, you would just sit there for 8 hours and just churn out report formats, or if it was a slow day, you'd sit there and, you know, BS with all your other service members and do nothing.
Wow, fascinating though. It's like, I'm always amazed people's life journeys take them to so many extraordinarily different places that were never expected. And what you're just describing to me, I mean, as a 15-year-old, I can't imagine you were expecting to end up doing that in the slightest.
No, not at all.
And so, Gary, so over those 10 years then, so what were some of the moments when you started to think, actually, hang on, what the fuck am I doing every day? Who is paying me, and why are they paying me? And what's all the training for? And what shifted? Were there specific moments, or I'd love to learn like how that played out.
Yeah. It wasn't until well into my career. It was probably, it's 2014 timeframe is, I qualified for this special operations program to go support those guys and enable those guys. And I moved in with one of my now best friends. His name's Tim. And, you know, you live with somebody, you start talking about everything else. Well, Tim is a libertarian, or at least like ascribes, he's probably an anarchist, but, you know, a practical libertarian, right? Like anarchy is just like communism. Like it's hard to realize in practice, but it's an ideology that you can ascribe to, and it allows you to frame your world in a specific way. So I started learning about like liberalism, like classical liberalism, right? And I started learning about Austrian economics and Mises and Rothbard. This fella named Tom Woods, who does he's like legendary podcaster. He's got tons of 30-minute podcasts for you to go ingest. There's another guy by the name of Jason Stapleton. At the time, he was doing a lot of like political commentary. He was a former Marine as well. This guy, Dave Smith, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Dave Smith. He's a comedian out of New York, but pretty well known. Yeah. He's been on some of the major media stuff. So started listening to these guys, starting listening in just more of the libertarian, circles. And, once you go down that road, it's pretty quickly that you're confronted with this like anti-war message, which is a very odd thing. Being, you know, I was at the tip of the spear, right? You know, special operations, like the tip of the spear. And here I am learning about money printing and some of the second and third order effects of money printing, namely the war machine. And then just as I'm going through and reflecting, I deployed prior to this. And I just remember thinking back to like some of these contracting companies that were running the bases and stuff, and how these guys just like sat around collecting a paycheck, doing almost nothing. And then experiencing that on a couple of deployments as well, where it's like, these guys were hired to like do generator maintenance for the base. And then we got a generator, but it was like outside the scope of their contract or something like that. And I'm just like, hey, can you just show me how to maintain this thing? Like, I don't need you to like do it. Like, this is our generator, but like, can you just, and they're like, nope, not in our contract. I can't, you know, can't teach you that. I'm like, dude, just like, please teach me how to change the oil on this generator. And he's like, no, that's not in the scope of our contract. We can't. Yeah. And so you just start getting all these touch points at the end of every fiscal year. So the fiscal year for the federal government ends at the end of September. So October 1st is like the new fiscal year. And end of August, you start getting a lot of like, hey, we've got this pile of money that we have to spend. And who wants to go on a course, or who wants some new like boots or whatever? And, you know, it's really cool when you're receiving this stuff, when you're like, oh, sweet. Yeah. I want to go to Boston for a Wireshark course. That's like completely not really needed, but like kind of cool. And like, you know, a novelty, nice to have, or like these, you know, awesome new like hiking, top of the line, like hiking boots, because everybody in the unit gets them. But then when you see that happening every year, and I'm like, hey, why do we always just like start spending a bunch of money in September? Like, oh, well, if we don't spend the budget that they give us, then they won't give us more money next year. So like, there's like this incentive to spend the entire budget that your department's allocated. So that way, when you go for like next year's budget, you can be like, look, we spent $1 million and we only had 750,000 or whatever, right? Like it allows you to perpetuate this whole like fiat game. And I do remember thinking, and again, this is like concurrent with learning the libertarian thesis. And I'm just like, wow, this is where the money printing happens. Like, if this is happening in just my one small unit within the military, like, is this happening where else is this happening in the government? And I'm almost certain that it happens everywhere in the federal government, where you get to this like fiscal year end and you're like, we need to spend our money so we can get even more money next year. And that's, it was just like, it was a confirmation of the things that I'd been learning in this like libertarian circles about like, you know, the money spending and the fake GDP number, right? Like this GDP number, that's like this magic number. And it's just like government spending is a huge part of it. So that was probably like the biggest thing that was, it was like two conflicting worldviews sort of being realized, but the, you know, luckily I had this like libertarian Austrian economic worldview to like look at what I was experiencing. Cause a lot of guys, they were just stoked. They're like, oh yeah, sweet. We're getting new boots. We're going to on this, you know, off-roading trip, whatever. Mm. Which is good training and like quality things. And like a lot of us used the equipment and the resources that we got. But at the same time, it was just like, it was completely wasteful.
Mm. It's like somehow people it's convenient not to dig any deeper. Take yeah. the boots, do yep. the trip. Don't yep. ask why. It's fascinating. I have interviewed in the past an Aussie guy that was in the Navy, and there was a story that he shared with me that is not public, and I won't share it now. But he essentially witnessed something whilst on active duty that was so nefarious. He's like, what the hell just happened? That yeah. is not what I was trained for. That's not what I was told the entire way through my career that we were here for. And I just saw it happen. And it was to do with off-market arms dealing. And it's just like, yep. oh my God. And not to lure you into a conversation like that, but the arc is very similar from what he explained. It's like you go in starry-eyed and slowly but sure, you're like, what am I actually doing here? And in his example too, he left. But there's people still there. And yep. they took the new boots, basically. And it's yeah. more convenient to continue to do that. And I think your insight's correct, Gary, in terms of how government budgeting works. Like if you come in under budget, oh, well, let's not give them as much next year.
Yeah.
That's an obvious choice for whoever's in charge of the purse strings. and so I'm intrigued then. So this transfer out and to really try and draw this point through is like, and again, listening to your Bitcoin Veterans episode, it's like a bunch of blokes with extreme competencies are no longer part of the organization that they gained those competencies from, but they're out in the world re-engineering their life. And in some cases, that's probably fucking hard because it's like, what the hell am I going to do with myself? I don't even know what to wear, let alone like
yeah.
what I'm going to eat or how I'm yeah. going to pay.
Yep.
But the network you guys are building is obviously very strong and highly skilled in a bunch of areas where the average civilian hasn't had to do things. And the idea of like, you know, you were talking about citadels and like rigging up certain types of radio transmitters between the two. And it's like, yeah, well, I wouldn't even begin to know how to do that. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if you've like
yeah.
run an army base in the middle of fuck knows where, well then sure, let's get the generators in, we've got to do this, that, and everything else. And so that transition, so Gary, so how did you end up choosing software development through that process? Was it something you were always interested in? You obviously didn't become an economist, even though you'd gone down that kind of liberty.
Yeah, yeah, thankful for that one. No, I mean, software was, I'd cut my teeth somewhat early on. Have you heard of the term thin client? It was like the original like cloud compute sort of thing where they put on our desktops at work this machine that had like 4 gigabytes of RAM, right? And like your phone probably has more than 4 gigabytes of RAM right now. And one of my jobs was parsing like massive CSV files, massive Excel sheets. And I would get these sheets, but they would be, you know, a gig and a half. And so when you'd open it on this thin client, there was not enough memory to handle what I was opening. So I had to learn Python, that was a recommendation that was given to me. And so I started like learning some very basic scripting. And then, you know, fast forward a little bit and I've always been technical. I was in, like a network communications technology class in high school. And I've always liked video games and computers, and it kind of has come natural to me. But the software piece didn't kick in until well after spending some time in SOCOM. So it was about 2 years out, right? Like the same point that I realized I needed to do something different. And I had picked up a lot of technical competencies, right? So the last 5 years, I did tactical signals intelligence, which was more of your like black box radio stuff, right? So I'm learning, you know, Wi-Fi is the easiest thing, right? If you've ever heard of war driving for Wi-Fi, it sounds maybe nefarious, but it was something that a lot of people would do in the past to scout out like open Wi-Fi routers, right? So you would just drive around scanning the Wi-Fi band and looking for like open Wi-Fi. Part of that's mapping the signals environment of a location, right? So it's like useful, you know, knowing where an open Wi-Fi is useful for like a communications plan, let's say. And so, you know, I started learning more about like technical protocols, and I started using Linux for the first time in my life, getting familiar with like the command line. You know, some of these boxes were not very user-friendly. And so you had to kind of learn the technical parameters around them to make them operate correctly. And so when I came to the point where it's like, I need to get out, I'm done with this. I had a good friend who was working at Microsoft, and he had made a trip back to the unit just to, like, wrap some things up before he fully got out. And I was like, hey, like, how is it there? And he's like, oh, if you show up and you do like half the work that you do here, like, you're just going to run circles around people. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, the civilian world is a completely different world, right? You get people that they can't even show up on time. And so knowing somebody that was already in there, and I'm like, okay, what do I need to do? And he's like, go learn C#. And I'm like, I don't know what that is, but sounds great. And so that's what I did. I just set out to go like learn C#. Yeah. And my friend, you know, he would send me resources and point me to here or the other, and like kind of helped mentor me in, as far as like what I should be learning. But really it came down to just, you know, like you said, after the kids go to sleep at 8 o'clock, you get to do your passion project. It was a very similar time, you know, young kid, just one at the time. So it was pretty manageable, but I would wake up at 5. I still try to wake up at 5 most days. But I would wake up, and for 2 hours before my family woke up, I would grind on YouTube videos or blogs or whatever. Finally got involved with like open source. There was like it's called Operation Code. It's a veteran focused, not like exclusive or anything, but veteran focused coding community, right? Where they had different open source projects, and they had a Slack channel that you could join. And, you know, there's all different topics to discuss, and they had mentors, and you could schedule mentor calls. So I got involved with that, and, ended up contributing to one of my first open source projects, like very, very minimal contribution, but contributing nonetheless. Started podcasting, you know, 40 hours of podcast a week was a real thing even before Bitcoin. And that's how I leveled up. I would, if I was taking the trash out, or if I was going to walk the dog, or anything that I was doing that I wasn't like actively engaged my brain, like, you know, dishes or whatever, I would throw earbuds in and I would listen to software engineering podcasts. Specifically, there's one called Coding Blocks, which I think they're still going to this day, but it was just three dudes getting together talking about, you know, whatever software book they wrote or whatever projects they were working on. For a couple of years, I just kind of built up a context window, right? Which is very appropriate in LLM times, but, you know, it was context. It was the same way that I learned a language, right? You build context, like, what does this word mean in this context or this sound or whatever? And so, I kind of started grinding on the software. I knew software was a thing, right? It was, you know, go learn to code, right? Was very much in full force at that time. This was like the 2018 timeframe. And so, and with my friend being at Microsoft, there was a potential there. He was working on like a government contract project that, you know, our clearances kind of moved over to. So it was an opportunity there as well. And leveled up on all the skills, and just dove headfirst and just started doing the thing, right? Like getting hands on and actually doing what I wanted to do after the Navy.
It's so cool, and I'm always blown away by the ability of people to learn, to react, to actually go and do something. Do you know what I mean? Like some people are not like this, as we know, but the concept of self-directed learning, and actually this is something that's really filtering into my now parenting. We can come onto that later, but if you decide you want to go and learn something, you go and learn it. And what you just described is just an awesome process. I'm loving the timeline. So if we can, we'll try and stick along it, because it's fun as an audience member to follow that. So it's roughly 2018, Gary. By this stage, you've left the military. or you're just coming out?
No, I was in the process.
You binged 2 years worth of podcasts. Okay.
2019 is when I got out.
The picture.
Okay. Bitcoin comes into the picture. There was actually a touch point. There was one touch point in like 2016. That friend Tim that I was talking about was like, hey, this is Bitcoin thing. He's Legend. Like, you're a nerd. Yeah. I love Tim. He's great. Shout out to Tim. But yeah. He's
Tim and I would be friends as well. Shout out to Tim. Yeah.
He was into like Forex trading and stuff. So he came across crypto more broadly.
Okay.
And I remember in like 2016, he was telling me about it, and I took like this old laptop. It was like an old Intel i3 laptop that I had tactically acquired from the Navy, we'll call it. And I remember trying to run a Bitcoin node and an Ethereum node on that same laptop, and I just bricked it. Like the laptop, I don't know why, but like the laptop just, I bricked the laptop, and then life continued. But I distinctly remember writing down a private key on a piece of paper. Like I do remember actually doing that, and remember thinking to myself, like, this random string of characters on this piece of paper is supposed to be like valuable or something. And then I completely memory hold it, right? Like deployments in life and, you know, then girlfriend, now wife, like things forget, just kind of took over.
Yep.
Yeah. So that was the first touch point, and it didn't even register really. It was just kind of one of those fun technical things that I was like, oh, I tried that and it didn't really work out. And then you fast forward to the end of 2021. I'm approaching the end of my second year at Microsoft. And this was at like the height of COVID stuff, right? So I joined Microsoft months before all the COVID things kicked off, and Microsoft went hard on the COVID thing. And so I was looking to exit. I was in office. I was quote unquote essential, which just meant they needed me in the office because when you're working on like government stuff, you have to be at the facility to work at it. And so I was trying to leave and do something different. And again, legendary Tim is, he was like, oh, Gary, go check out this crypto stuff. He was making a killing, right? Like he was doing really well for himself, right? 2021, like early 2021, you know, everything was going great. And he's like, oh, you look into this crypto thing. Like you should go get a job there. You're a software engineer. You know, you got the pedigree now that you worked at big tech and blah, blah, blah. And so I remember I went and I interviewed at Celsius and I tried to interview at like Kraken and like some of these other companies. It didn't work out for the best, I think. But it did start me, like I bought like $300 of Bitcoin and $300 worth of Ethereum. And I sent the Ethereum to myself because he was like, oh yeah, like you could stake and do all these smart contract stuff. And, you know, being a dev, I was like, oh, this is awesome. And I remember sending like, you know, $300 worth of Ethereum to myself. And it was like $30 in fees to do it. And I was like, oh. And I remember talking back to Tim and he's like, oh yeah, you need like $3,200 if you want to start doing like staking and all this other stuff. Remember, two kids, right? Like, and I'm like, yeah, $3,200 is not in the ballpark of something that I can just like throw at this random internet money thing. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, let me send the Ethereum. I sent it back to, I think Coinbase I bought it on. And so I sent it back and I was like, all right, well, what's this like Bitcoin thing? Cause those were the two. He's like, oh, well, go check out the Bitcoin stuff. And I had a node up and running within a day, right? It was like free, open source, very straightforward. Like node started to think, I started to sync a node on my gaming laptop like that day. I was like, oh, okay. Like this is not costing me money. You know, I ended up sending myself Bitcoin to like the Bitcoin Core wallet that I had on the laptop. And I was like, oh, okay, that worked. And it wasn't like an egregious amount of fees. And yeah, that was kind of just like the lack of friction probably was what was, I was like, okay, this is a thing. And so I started just going deeper down the rabbit hole. I touched briefly on like Monero and I was kind of excited about that for a little bit. At the end of 2021, unfortunately, my father had a heart attack and was in the hospital. He's still alive to this day, but I was in the hospital. I had to, you know, travel back to where I'm from, and I had a copy of the Bitcoin Standard at the time. So I'm like sitting in this hospital, waiting to see if my dad's okay, and I'm like digesting the Bitcoin Standard, and it was this almost this perfect marriage of you know, this engineering discipline that I just started on, right? I'm like a couple years into my software engineering career. And then the Austrian economics, right? That I had sort of like self-studied in the past. And I was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is like the answer to the money printer. Like, we fixed the central bank problem. And I can understand this. This is like, it's software. And so then you just start to ask more questions. And I went really hard on the macro and the econ stuff because it was a much more familiar thing, right? I was very nascent in my like technological and engineering career. And so the economic stuff was like way easier to digest. And so I found myself back on Twitter. I did end up leaving Microsoft. I was at this other job doing software. And I got laid off at the end of the year there, along with 14% of the headcount at the company. And it was for a good reason. Like, I was falling down the rabbit hole and not really doing my job. And so it's like, I'm in like Twitter spaces and I'm, you know, reading blogs and I'm like setting up a Lightning node and like losing a bunch of sats trying to figure out Lightning. Yeah. Like, yeah, it just became like this obsession. But it was really from,
yeah, you get the
bug. Yeah.
Like, I have to learn more about this thing.
Well, it was a solution to so much more, right? It wasn't just the money printing. It was like, you know, this COVID thing had happened and I'm like, man, this is like, I was in a very dark place for COVID, right? Like, there was, you know, for the first time in my life, I reached out to like a therapist to talk and I'm like, hey, like I might be crazy or something. You know what I mean? Like you're like, there's just like this world and everybody's losing their mind. And turns out I was like one of the very few sane people out there, unfortunately. And so, you know, it was like a transition from like this darkness. And now it's like, there's this Bitcoin thing. And I was like, oh, like, this is it. Like, this is, you know, this is FU money. You know, they can't tell me what to do if I have this thing. They can't debase me. And I think by like May of 22, I'm like texting the wife, hey, we should liquidate our retirement and go all in on Bitcoin. And let's just say we're still not all in on Bitcoin. So there was definitely some like, no, you're fucking crazy. But it was fine. It was good. It slowed me down. I'm very impulsive sometimes. It would have been the right decision, financially speaking. But it was not the right decision for us at the time. And it's fine. We're doing just well without it. But yeah, I was ready. I was like laser-eyed maxi by the Q2 of 2022 after just a few months. And I was like, this is it. Like, it's this or nothing else. Like, there's, and I was looking, right. I was always looking for why it wasn't going to work. And I still look for that to this day. And that's kind of one of the best things about Bitcoin is there's a lot of people out there that are riding this Bitcoin train. And they're like, yeah, let's look for anything in the future that could stop this train. And I don't think anything stops this train, to quote Lynn Alden, but and that's a different train she's talking about. But now I truly did feel like there was this thing that I could use. Right. And that's when I encountered the Bitcoin veterans, eventually I was like, oh sweet. Like, there's other veterans out there that get it. And then you just start to develop even more in depth and more nuance around like the implications of Bitcoin. Right. And then you start to realize it's like, oh, I'm going to be a major capital allocator in the next 5 to 10 years. Like, what does that mean? Right. That's a question that I'd never, you know, middle-class blue collar family, growing up, it was never like, I was never groomed or trained or knew anything about like having capital to allocate. And now here I'm faced with this absolute pristine collateral that is one of the most valuable things in this world. And now I got to figure out like what to do with it, right? But what does it mean to have this? What does it mean to be part of this? What does it mean to keep this thing going, right? Like, there's a Bitcoin continues, yes, TikTok next block, but it continues in no small effort by the people that every day wake up and decide to push this movement forward, to educate a new person or to write some new tool that helps smooth that friction out. But yeah, that was kind of like where Bitcoin came in was, just, you know, looking to make some money like everybody else. And,
it comes in like a fucking freight train though. Cause you're like, hang on, that experience back then, that experience then, that experience then, that experience then. Ah, it's all connected. And this is the thing, the train that's just pulled them all together. And Gary, this time we've already spent on this call, and from the way that you've taught me about the decisions that you've already made to date and what your plans are for the future, you know, being interested in or focused purely on family and Jesus, and we'll come to Jesus later, but the fact that you're going to be a capital allocator in the future is something that really excites me, because you're going to take all of these different experiences you've had thus far and assimilate them in a way that makes sense for you, but built on top of something that actually works. So that's really simple. Within a day, you had a node up and running. Great. And again, when I was researching for this conversation, you strike me as someone who I love learning from. And it's because as an investor in the past, you can cheat, basically. You can look at what other people are investing in, and you can go and see, well, what do they know? What's their background? What's their experience? What's their skills? And you can share their due diligence and say, okay, that's a good bet. Well, you have a much more technical way of looking at the world than I do. And if Gary says the tech works and he's buying into this thing, then for me, I'm like, great. I could sit next to Gary and say, okay, I know from an investment perspective, these things are all happening over here. You know, capital risk, inflation risk, all these other things that you cannot control your purchasing power against unless you buy Bitcoin. But like, what's under the hood of this thing? What is a node? What is open source? How do these things talk to each other? And I'm like, oh, great. And that's why these kind of conversations are so good. Because I'm like, okay, there's people out there that are looking at that stuff and making sure it works. Oh, yeah. I mean, Bitcoin, it just gets you kind of fired up, doesn't it? And so,
yeah.
So Gary, just to continue along this line, are you working in a Bitcoin company now, or working in a more like fiat job and kind of stacking sats where you can?
I work for a fiat company that happens to mine a lot of Bitcoin. And yeah, so my day job is software engineering for a large pool. I won't get into the specifics, but yeah, it's a fiat company that happens to mine a lot of Bitcoin. And I have the opportunity to work on the Bitcoin side of that stack.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, what do you think have been, if you could remember any, like the specific aha moments that happened over those few years? Was like a specific day, or you saw a specific article or something, or you listened to a specific podcast and you're like, oh,
yeah,
shit, I wish I'd realized that earlier, but obviously you hadn't.
One of the things that really, excuse me, one of the things that solidified it for me was the Sailor Breedlove series. Right. So it was like the first few, I think it was the first 9 episodes or whatever of What is Money?
Yeah,
it was just one of those first touch points. And you listen to Saylor break down like the history of a variety of different topics, but first and foremost, like the energy aspects of Bitcoin and the channeling of energy and the efficient channeling of energy and all this. And that, like, the, again, it was an engineering thing, right? So it was, oh, this is like Bitcoin mining, and this system that takes in this electrical energy is like hyper robust from an engineering perspective. And then, you know, in that same story, it talks about like the civilizations that figured out, you know, gravity first, or the civilizations that figured out like water, how to do the aqueducts and stuff, like all these breakthrough in technology that has advanced the human race has largely been some derivative, if not a direct application of like energy, right? If you think about like refrigeration, right? That was one of the things he brought up. It's like, oh, well, we can now store energy as food well into the future, right? We're channeling energy more efficiently. And so Bitcoin as energy money, some people call it, was like a very, very easy, like it just all made sense, right? The 9 episodes, the 18, whatever hours of podcasts with, Saylor and Breedlove, it just, all that just like really clicked on the sort of historical significance of this Bitcoin thing. And that was regardless of all the economic stuff, right? The economic stuff just seemed like obvious. But the energy implications of this engineered money.
So cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
It somehow though brings into it brings into context what you're actually looking at. And it was also areas of history that were very much connected to like technology and startup style thought processes. Like they talk about triremes and the importance of a certain type of naval technology in the Mediterranean X many hundred years before. It's like, God, I'm really in the weeds here. What is going on? But without the context, you don't get the importance today.
Yeah, context is really, it's like everything if you're learning about something. I don't think it's a mistake that like if you're using AI or these LLMs, they have these context windows that they can only fit so much data into. And we, even as humans, like we only have so much context window that we can use, right? In your immediate vicinity, right? All your senses provide your context window for you. Right. So right now you're like staring at a screen. This is like you have your visual context window that has this like very narrow scoping, but you have your scent and your smell and your hearing and everything like that. But it all like builds, that's like the input, but it all builds in your mind. And luckily humans were able to do like this abstract thinking, right? We're able to like think about the things that don't exist and put those pieces together in our mind, visually or otherwise. And so we can build up a context and sort of like play that context forward in time. Like it's like our minds are almost like time machines, right? Because you can take, well, like what if I did this or what if this happened? And I think that's where you get a lot of these, you know, low time preference thinkers. The low time preference allows for your brain to develop these future contexts. Right. It allows, like, if you're living a high time preference, if you're just paycheck to paycheck, like you're just constantly, your context window is constantly refreshing and you're being bombarded by just like having to like constantly refresh, like what's going on in your context window to adjust. But if you can smooth that out and you can, you know, figure out Bitcoin to buy yourself some time, eventually, right. It doesn't happen overnight, but eventually like you can have more free time to think about like, okay, well, what if I did this? What if, you know, I bought that piece of land. What if I started this business? Or what if anything you want now becomes possible because you have the time and the ability. Like your context window is not like completely full of all this garbage, low time or high time preference stuff. You can try to build a future context in your mind of like, where are we going? What am I doing? Right? What is my life about?
Oh, it's so true. Yeah, I said this a few times recently, but and we touched on it at the start. By choosing to not own a house, yes, that was by choice, but on the Maslow hierarchy of needs, at the very bottom, you've got food and shelter. And what I had unwittingly done was I had chosen to be constantly solving the problem of shelter. And what that means, because of constantly moving Airbnb the whole time, etc., is you can't focus on any problems higher up the scale than that. And that is capital accumulation in a sense. It's like, okay, how can you focus on a job that isn't just like, you know, feed a man a fish, you feed him to today, teach a man to fish, you feed him for life. And again, I mean, this is great safety and stuff. Have you read any of his economics books, like the Economics 101 that he's written, as well as the Bitcoin Standard?
I have not, no. I did the Bitcoin Standard. I read the Fiat Standard, but I've not continued on the safe journey. You know, at this point, it's like the economics work.
It's good.
Yeah, principles of economics.
You don't need to, in a way. Yeah, that's right. Excuse me, I didn't say it correctly. Yeah, I really enjoyed that and talking about like how is it that today you've got the largest fishing trawler in the world and why that's essentially a series of capital allocation decisions that enables you to create something like that. And it's one of the beauties of sound money, obviously, is as you slowly start chipping away at, you know, whether it's a DCA into Bitcoin or you sell something and buy some Bitcoin, your time preference lowers and you have a better outlook on the future, which means you can start thinking about these things. You know, and even the idea of having three children, was that what you set out with? And you touched on the fact you might have more. Do you think that these economic factors play into those decisions to have multiple children?
I didn't consider economics at all. Like I set out and I even had a pretty crude comment about you know, breeding with my wife until she's dry or something along those lines, at our wedding rehearsal. So very early on, I knew that I wanted a big family, and I'd be perfectly happy with the three kids we have now, but we'll see what the future holds for us.
Okay. That's interesting. Cause it's, obviously everyone's different, Gary. Some people will talk a lot about finances. Some people will say, you know, nah, fuck it. Wasn't even part of the conversation. Just have as many kids as possible. Gary, where I'd like to go now is the second major thing that you said you were, you know, what your life was about was Jesus. So what does Jesus mean to you?
Oh, Jesus is the redemption of my soul and many others. It's a promise of a resurrection after this life. It is a realization that the world that we live in is not the world that we're destined for. And while we're here, you know, we are to be stewards of this world. But ultimately, through Christ, we have this resurrection opportunity. We have, you know, Christ will return, and with him, all of his believers will come with him. That's not something. That was something newer in my life. Raised Catholic, went to Catholic school for a few years, became a vocal atheist for a number of years while I was in the Navy. Just like through logical, like I figured it all out. But then through studying like complex system design and just kind of seeing the world for what it is, that there is like good and evil. There are evil forces at work in this world. It's hard not to come to the conclusion that you know, God is real. And if God is real, you know, Jesus was either a liar, a lunatic, or a Lord. And if you examine sort of the empirical historical evidence, he wasn't lying, probably. There's a small chance that he was a lunatic. And so, and in this, there's a lot more to this. But, you know, if those two are untrue, then he is the Lord and Savior of our world here. And so, yeah.
And I'm fascinated by this journey that you've been through. So not to project myself on you, Gary, in the slightest, but I feel like I'm getting more and more open to the idea of religion being a serious part of my life when it's basically not really been true. You know, having grown up in the UK, we'd go to church a couple times a year for Easter and Christmas. It's Church of England.
Yeah.
So an offshoot of Christianity. But it just wasn't taken very seriously. And when you start looking into it more and more, it's like basically, you know, the government has overtaken religion. You know, the prime minister or the president is God and the government is the family. And it's perverse in its nature in many ways. So was there a moment that you can think back to or something that happened in your life? You already mentioned looking at systems design, perhaps something more emotional. I'd love to learn more basically.
No, I mean, it was really like a logical deduction that I had. And first of all, I'm not a fan of religion, but I do go to church, right? Like I think religion is like a man-made organizational construct that is can become bastardized and controlled and put to nefarious use. You see that throughout history, right? Like people using like religion as like this dogma for control. So I'm not necessarily a big fan of religion, but the thing that's
interesting. So I have sort to be careful with the definition of that. So religion and faith are not the same thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can have, I think a religion is more of like an organizational institutional type of thing. And this is just my opinion, right? People might interpret it differently, but you know, your faith and spirituality is completely separate from any religion, right? Like it is truly a relationship with God. And if you're curious, like just go get a Bible, like go get a Bible and just like, just read through the Bible and like take notes on like what you think of, you know, the scripture and the Old Testament, the New Testament. There's, you know, you don't have to go to church necessarily to have a relationship with God. I think that's what religion has told us. And I think that's patently false. And if you read the gospel, then like you realize that you don't necessarily need like the temple and the religion to have a relationship with God. That's like the old way of doing things. And with Jesus, we have a different way of doing things now. We have an open way of doing things. But the piece that sort of like solidified it was, again, this sailor conversation with Breedlove, and it, or maybe it was some other sailor conversation. But he made the comment of like, to engineer is divine. And like, for whatever reason, that like kind of really stuck with me. And I can't remember if it was him that kind of elaborated on this, but the way I interpreted that, it was, you know, when you solve a problem with engineering and you do it well, and I would say that like doing it well means you're sharing with other people. Like building a bridge solves a problem of like, I can't get across this river. And so if you do that, you build that bridge and you build it well, so that way it stands there for the rest of time. Other people get to benefit from what you've engineered. And if you share what you've engineered, right? Like, oh, hey, I had this thing. It was called the Keystone, and it like made it so this arch didn't fall down. You know, sharing that knowledge, sharing what you've engineered to make your life better. Even if you just built a bridge on your property and nobody else ever gets to use it, if you're able to share how you did that, if you're able to share the engineering that you did, you can reduce the friction and the burden of this life, right? Of this physical material life that we live in, by sharing these engineering practices, by engineering in a way that is shareable, right? And this goes to like the open source piece of things. Every line of code that I write that goes out into the open source world, I'm not guaranteed that it's going to make anybody's life easier, but now there is the potential for it to make somebody else's life easier. And then you couple that sort of like philosophy with looking at like, you know, God engineering the world and like the infinite amount of complexity in the tip of my finger, right? Like if you think really, really down to the fine grain, like what is going on the tip of my finger? There's like all these atoms, there's like some germs in there, right? Like there's skin particles, like all these things all have to, they all work together. They're all working in unison or friction. And I don't think that's a mistake, right? It's not a mistake. These complex systems don't just like appear, right? I don't necessarily buy into that description anymore. Complex systems have very intentional design. And as I started studying, you know, the cloud, we'll call it, right, during my time at big tech, and then learning about Bitcoin and like, okay, like Satoshi, we know Satoshi created this like pretty complex, it's simple, but it's also pretty complex system called Bitcoin. And all these other things sort of like building on top of Bitcoin didn't just like happen out of like happenstance. It was like people intentionally were engineering, you know, the mempool. They were in engineering like the Stratum mining protocols, and they were doing it to solve their own problem. Then fortunately, they shared that with, well, for the most part, they shared a lot of this with the rest of the world. And so the rest of the world, like Satoshi could have run Bitcoin just himself and Hal and like not made it like peer-to-peer, but instead the engineering that Satoshi did and sharing of that with the Cypherpunk mailing list and then with the broader, you know, world enabled for a whole lot of people to dig themselves out of fiat slavery. And wow, I think there's also so like a,
please go.
Just like the, on the good and evil subject, right? Like the corruption of the money. You know, now we have like an engineered solution that fixes this corruption of money. And that's a powerful thought, and I don't think it happened by chance, right? I think it was a God-given gift to us for this lifetime that we have to live for this short period of time on Earth.
Well, and the creator of Bitcoin in the Genesis block with the reference to, you know, Chancellor on brink of second bailout, very, very, very clear indication that one of the inspirations behind creating Bitcoin was an antidote to modern central banking.
Yep.
But okay, so to take what you're talking about then is the extraordinary complexity that we see just in daily life. It's like that story of a pencil, that no one person can create even a pencil because there's so many required self-interested economic actors to actually create one. No independent person could do it alone. And your point about the end of my finger, I mean, I don't fucking know what's in there, right? Put into the mix.
Right, yeah.
Around me that even means that I'm stood on the floor and not fucking floating up in the air or whatever the case might be. And so So to engineer is divine. The thought process being is like someone out there somewhere must have engineered this, because it doesn't just appear out of nowhere.
Okay. Yeah, and there's one
counteraction to that point B.
I mean, there's like the evolutionary theorists out there, like talking about how, like, oh yeah, well, your finger is just like a byproduct of all this evolutionary stuff. But even if you go back to the beginning, right? Even atheists believe in a miracle. It's called the Big Bang. Well, what's the Big Bang? I don't know. Mm. Okay, it's a miracle then, right? So it's like, is it the Big Bang miracle, or is it the miracle that God created the Earth? And it's like, which one do you start your, you know, timeline on? And so that's kind of like a flippant answer, but you know, it is true in a sense where if you don't believe in God, if you don't believe God created this, there's. Go ahead.
Take a Bitcoin design philosophy. It's like, verify that, mate. Verify there was a Big Bang.
Right.
You can't. You were born from two parents somewhere in the world within the last however many years. You cannot go back past the day you were born. And even then, before you're 10, you don't have a fucking clue what's going on around you.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a huge subject, isn't it, this? So, Gary, to try and home into like how this has changed things for you, like how do you feel every day once you have started taking Jesus more seriously and started having a higher faith, if that's the right way I might describe it? Do you feel very different?
Yeah.
What might be some of the ramifications of it?
I mean, the feelings and the ramifications, I do feel different. I feel hopeful, even more so than like after like figuring out that the Bitcoin is a solution. But also the teachings of Christ is like, you're not in this alone, right? Like we as humans, and this is something that I think even like a lot of like just your non-faith-based like academics have acknowledged, Sebastian Younger being one of them, but like a tribe, right? Like there's like people that you should be living in community with. I think our society and just like the incentives of our society have like driven us all apart. Like there's a very divisive incentive structure with the fiat monetary system, mm-hmm. and all the derivatives thereof. So I feel great. You know, there's a men's group at church that I know I can call on for anything, and vice versa, right? Like I went and helped this one of the guys, there was a whole group of us like patching a roof for his shed. You know, there's people whose kids that like will watch them, they'll watch our kids, sort of things. So it's this community now that is, I know we share like a moral foundation, right? So that's not necessarily something that I would have easily found elsewhere. I definitely had community within the military, right? But that was on this sort of like rough foundation of this fiat military that we're part of. The more I've prayed, the more my prayers have been answered. And that's not to say that there's not been like downturns, right? Like we're all human. But I've seen more of my prayers answered, than I could have ever imagined. And it was, I don't think it was by chance. I do think prayer works, and just having that as an option and also having something to sort of like anchor to aside from this Bitcoin thing, right? Like it's very easy to like anchor to Bitcoin for everything and like, you know, sunning your balls and like eating all the steak and stuff. But having questions and asking the questions, like the hard questions, and having a frame, like having scripture to go back and look at and frame around, that has been immensely powerful too, because even in my atheist times, like there's like these common sort of moral codes that are perfectly in line with like Christ's teaching and everything like that, right? So it's probably largely due to my like Catholic upbringing that I already had some of these like thoughts and ideas. But the more I've examined the, you know, scripture and gospel and everything, the more I see like how right Jesus was as well. Like there's all these things, that are just very, very much in line with what I see as like the Bitcoin ethos, but also the Christian, like the ethos of Christ, right? Like there is some sort of like moral alignment with a hard and sound money that will drive people to an incentive structure that aligns with like this Christian view. You see a lot of people talking about like American views, right? Like Bitcoin is like better money for America because it takes like the money out of politics and all this other stuff. But, you know, American was founded largely by Christians, right? So I don't think it's a mistake that there's these, you know, viewpoints that are very aligned with like individualism and liberty, small government, like people just like do good to each other, get out of each other's way and like don't kill each other, right? Like there's all these, parallels and lessons to be learned from the gospel and from scripture that are very, very much applicable when you're trying to live an intentional and well-meaning life on a Bitcoin standard as well. So it's been like reinforcing, I guess, like there's been this feedback loop of having, thinking about like long-term, low time preference stuff. You know, if you're an asshole, and you live a low time preference life, constantly being a jerk, like the reputational capital that you build, the social capital, you were talking about other forms of capital, your social capital is going to be trash. You can have all the Bitcoin in the world, but if nobody likes you, like who are you going to go buy something from? And if you do, like, you know, maybe they'll upcharge you because they know you have all the Bitcoin, but you're a huge jerk. And there's something too to just like giving away. Yeah, it's, you know, it's I found a lot of joy with like donating, right? Like,
have you ever read this book before, Honest Money by Dr. Gary North?
I have not. No. I will note that down though.
Biblical Principles of Money and Banking. I haven't yet finished it. It was recommended to me by shout out to Seb Walker, who came on the show earlier this year, who was also describing his journey towards Christ, and certainly for him a big shift in his life in terms of how he has a relationship with Christ now. But the book was very interesting, at least what I've read so far, in terms of how many obvious references within the Bible the author finds in relation to sound money. So the references to gold and the description of corruption when the money is broken. And it's, you'll really enjoy reading it, I'm sure, given what you were just describing to me.
Okay.
Do you speak with God? Do you have, when you make a prayer, do you have a process that you go through, or a time of day where you have a practice? Like, what do you find
effective? Not anything prescriptive. You know, I do, my office is in the basement of a church. I'm friends with the pastor and he rents me an office in the basement. So sometimes I'll just go like in the middle of the day, if I'm feeling whatever way, thankful or distraught or distressed or whatever, depending on how the day's going, you know, I'll go up and just kneel in front of the altar and just like, I just talk like just whatever's on my mind, and direct it as a conversation with God. You know, sometimes when I'm driving, I try to be intentional on Nostr to post a daily devotional. There's like a Bitcoiner devotional called The Daily Seed. It's by this guy, Daniel Howard, who drove like 3 hours to come to my meetup and gave me this book in person. So I had like a signed copy of it. It's cool. 365-day daily devotional. And it's got a QR code that looks like, it's like the seed signer. If you've ever seen a seed signer, it's got the 12 words Yeah, it you know, it's a scripture verse, and then the QR code has some blurb. Like I don't write those blurbs. Those are like, if you scan the QR code in this book, it gives you the blurb. So you have to scan the QR code to get like the devotional like feedback, I guess. And then I just paste that into Nostr and post it. That's probably like the biggest like habit that I've been intentional about. But yeah, outside of that, no, I don't have like a prescriptive or like consistent way that I'm, you know, praying or talking to God. We try to pray before meals sometimes, as a family. And, you know, we go to church on Sundays. But outside of that, no, it's just kind of wherever, whenever it's happening, whether I'm feeling stressed and overwhelmed or just like incredibly thankful for something. I talk to God.
Cool. And not to take away from your experience and what you're describing, but the spiritual journey that I've been on the last, I mean, it's quite a few years now, but I would say it's almost more of a kind of Buddhist experience in terms of it's been a lot of meditation and interacting with some higher level consciousness and raising vibration, accessing different frequencies. And the comparison between what you're describing and that experience is so close. And really, it's all about our intention and, sorry, our attention.
Yep.
So where we point our attention, we are extraordinarily creative problem-solving beings, engineers, divine engineers, perhaps. You know, literally, like you point your head this way and you say, I want to build this thing, or I want to say thank you for this, or whatever the case might be. And stuff changes. It's absolutely, it's mad, really. And it's certainly not something that's taught in school. Oh my gosh, whoa. Okay.
I mean, there is...
Gary, any comments? Yeah.
I think, well, I was going to ask, and forgive me if it's a little too torrid, but have you ever experienced psychedelics?
I have done LSD... 20 years ago now, a number of times, magic mushrooms,
okay.
times, but more like recreational drug abuse as a teenager in early 20s, rather than any specific kind of plant medicine style approach as to what it would be like now. So, I had a guy on the pod actually talking a lot about South American plant medicines, and it's something that's come up for me a few times lately, but I've not done anything about it. So I'd be open-minded to absolutely.
I think if you're meditating and you do feel like you're tapping into, like if you're able to focus your attention and meditate and there is a spiritual aspect to that, you know, one, like plant medicine is just that. It should be used as medicine. I think like if you're just trying to like trip on shrooms, like you're probably the chances of you experiencing some like demonic force in the spiritual realm. Yeah. Like, you know, I've never like tripped on shrooms. I microdose mushrooms to like, it helps with focus. Right. And that, again, that's a medicinal use. But I've talked to so many people that were like, yeah, you know, tripping on shrooms. Like, you know, I talked to some like serpent thing, right? And so I think there is, I believe there is like this other spiritual heavenly realm, right? And there's a lot of, you know, lowercase g gods that like exist there and influence the world around us. But you know, that meditation that you're doing, that attention bringing, you know, there's, I think there's probably plenty of historical precedents that like people do have the ability to sort of like expose themselves and tap into, you know, this spiritual heavenly realm and what their intentions are very, very much matter, right? Because if you're going there just for, hey, we're going to party and have a good time, the chances of you meeting some spiritual entity there that's going to like agree with you and lure you into, you know, whatever the seven deadly sins are, right? Lust, greed, sloth, whatever. I think your chances of it experiencing something negative like that, even if it's not like negative in the moment, right? Like you're feeling good or whatever, you know, the detraction from your soul might be damaging in the hindsight, right? Like if you're tripping on whatever and like having a big orgy, like that's not good for your soul, right? Like I think that's like a pretty objective thing, that this something that is not good for you, even though at the time it's like this, you know, spiritual experience that is like quote unquote fun. But yeah, I all that to say is I think, you know, if you're meditating, that is a form of prayer, right? Like that's a well-documented historical form of prayer. And taking that time and attention and even just focusing it inward, right? Like we were created in God's image. So being able to just attention and bring attention to yourself. And I think the Buddhist teachings, you know, having this meditative state to try to just like inner calm and peace and focus, it's very, very similar to you know, trying to pray and contact God, because God, we were created in his image, and Christ is in all of us. And so if you're meditating and you're feeling, I don't say enlightened might not be the right word, but I think it's totally plausible that you're tapping into something spiritual there.
Absolutely. And what predominantly I use it for a de-stressing process, and I'll literally just lie down, hit 10 minutes on my alarm, and just see what comes up. And I write some notes afterwards almost every time, like in a state of flow, and just whatever comes out is totally fine. And often what was stressing me out is no longer stressing me out. The direction I want to take is revealed through what I write in my notes. And it's funny in a sense, like software developer, you'll understand what I mean by this. Like from an entrepreneurship perspective, you've got two schools of thought. One is the build it and they will come, of which I think Satoshi is probably the best example of that I've ever seen. And the other is a much more engineered kind of customer discovery process, where it's like only supply what the customer wants. And maybe Apple is a good example of someone that did that very well, Steve Jobs initially. By meditating, you're tapping into that first camp. It's like, who are you talking to? What are they saying? It's like a higher sense of consciousness. And if you, to use the word faith, have faith in that, those are your angels, those are your guiding thoughts, follow them. And prayer would be very similar. I actually had Levi on the show a couple of podcasts back, and he was teaching me how he journals as part of his prayer. So he will speak to God and write to God, and what God says to him through his journaling, he ends up, you know, becoming a rational actor of. And that's how he makes decisions. I thought, wow, that's such a fascinating way of deciding things in life. And it's so different to what I was doing. And really, that's what this podcast is all about for me, is understanding how different people make different decisions and where they take you. Of which really there's no wrong answer. But how we reach those conclusions are all slightly different. So Gary, what I'd love to go to now is, and we'll wrap it up in the next like 10 minutes or so. Thank you so much for your time. I've really loved, you know, getting to know yourself and this story of yours so far. But I can't not dive deeper into Nostr. So what does Nostr mean to you, and why are you using it?
Nostr to me is, one, it's opting out of the algorithms. Twitter's algorithm was feeding me all the most heinous stuff. It was like, is either like boobs or people getting murdered. Right. And that's just my past life was a lot of that and vices and everything. So like the algorithm, was pretty toxic. And you can be intentional. Like I hear a lot of people, oh, you just have to like train it and do the list and like put in the work. And, I had no interest in doing that. I definitely jumped on the hype train when it came to Nostr. It was like, you know, the Dorsey train, and a lot of the people that I follow and respect in the space were like, oh, this Nostr thing, this is it. We're going all in on Nostr. And I did that. But over time, to me, it's fascinating. Again, we'll take it back to context, because the algorithm is defining your context, right? It might be the same data, right? So you and I, if we're on Facebook or Twitter, it's the same like underlying data, but they are deciding the context in which we see that data. But with Nostr, we can share the same data, and it's all structured JSON that is signed by keys. And so there's some like authenticity and some verification guarantees there. But ultimately what Nostr enables is, if there's this huge data set now that is your social interaction and more, that you are able to craft and decide how you want to view that, right? You get to determine what your context window looks like. Every time you load up Twitter or X, you know, that you have almost no say unless you spend gobs and gobs of hours like refining this thing. But even then you can get rugged, right? Like Elon could reset the algorithm or whatever. And you're not really 100% certain how the algorithm works, but you are being fed a view of this data. And ultimately it's just a view of the data. But with Nostr, you as an individual get to decide what your view of the data is. And then furthermore, if you want to render every kind one note as like, you know, a cat with a speech bubble of what the kind one note is, like you can just do that, right? It's your own interpretation of this data, and nobody else has to agree with you or even use your interpretation of this data. But we can know that the data is like verifiably, you know, like it was signed by a key that you're following. And it's in a certain structure. So that structure is important, and you could just view all the data as raw JSON data if you really wanted to, if you wanted to like look at the matrix. But ultimately Nostr allows for this, for anyone to sort of decide what they want to view. And most people are going to be comfortable with using like Domus and Primal and Amethyst, right? And they'll fall into seeing these data contexts using these predefined patterns that are kind of influenced by other scenarios, right? Like, you know, Primal, Domus, Amethyst, all kind of like Twitter clones almost, right? Mm-hmm. But the other stuff in Nostr, the other stuff, the yet unexplored or the very, very nascent exploration of this other stuff in Nostr that is not just the notes is, you know, there are people out there looking at doing like webs of trust or using something called like a graph database to build out these graphs of the different events. So not just like identities necessarily, but like the different events and things like that. And that I think is super powerful. If you look at even, you know, one of the most scariest companies in the world, I would assert is Palantir. So what does like Palantir do? And I've used their software. It's a giant like graph, right? It's a giant data context view. Except it is completely closed source and proprietary. And if you listen to any sort of, there's a fellow that did like a podcast, and I don't remember his role there, but it was basically what they did was they had a very generic data set, and then they would embed like engineers into each of these customers. And the customers would talk to the Palantir engineers and be like, hey, we want to look at it like this, or we want to add this. And because the core data set was this very like loosely defined thing, each of these engineers could like kind of adapt and build on top of this data context to adapt it to what the customer needed. And then vice versa. Oh, if customer A likes it this way, customer B doesn't, like, now there's a way to like share that and be like, oh, hey, look at this, how we did it. And I see Nostr having a very, very similar opportunity. Not to say that it's like a malicious thing, right? Not that it's going to be used for like mass surveillance, but you can just mass surveil Nostr. Right, you can go build a network graph of the events, the entities, of everything like that, or you could do that completely in your own silo. Right, so like there's this optionality to it. I can run my own relay. I can have me and just the family and some close friends on my own relay. Right, so now I know like my data context is very limited in scope. Or you can go out to the public wild relays, and you can have like this vast array of like, you know, as many notes, good, bad, or otherwise, as you possibly want. And you get to decide sort of what that means to you and how you want to display it.
Yeah, it's cool, isn't it? I've seen all sorts of different pitches from people playing around that kind of other stuff, such as like remote security access. So if you've got a site somewhere and you want to give someone access to that site, you could use Nostr key pairs to check their social graph before giving them access.
Yeah.
And the information that the Nostr key pair gives you is far, far higher quality than any reference anyone could ever supply. Oh, I trust Gary, let him on. So why do you trust Gary? Oh, well, here's a whole email as to the reasons I trust him. It's like, no, give me his public-private key pair on Nostr. Well, not the private one, obviously, but you know, give me his MPAR. Yeah. Okay, I can see all the interactions he's had digitally for the last year, and I can make an assessment on the back of that as to whether or not he's going to be a self-interested economic actor that I can trust with my private property. Like, massive. And totally decentralized, right? So there's no middleman that's going to be able to make someone's web of trust look better than someone else's. It's literally proof of work.
Yeah.
That is then on an MPUB. I've seen insurance plays. I've seen medical record plays. It's very exciting. Yeah. To me, it's like it's starting to hoover up basically all of my attention over and above Bitcoin itself. And part of that's because the Bitcoin price action is underwhelming in terms of some of the targets people would have said. But equally, it's still, you know, if you were buying back in 2022, Q3, Q4, you've done fucking well. So, you know, maybe there's some other things to go and work on. But I particularly like the lack of platform risk, you know, because if you think about it from a capital allocation perspective, putting time and energy into any of those digital monopolies, where at some point, should they choose, they could switch you off, that's the biggest waste of attention I've ever seen.
Yeah, there was just one of the projects I work on, Stratum V2. Well, the Stratum V2, one of the developers like got their GitHub account suspended. So, you know, years of work on code and software, and they like GitHub just like snapped a finger and was suspended. Luckily, he was restored. You know, there was no issues, but there was a period of days where it was like potentially, you know, years of work were just gone and completely rug pulled out from under him. I think there's going to be some alternative hosting solutions, but
yeah,
go ahead.
What is Stratum V2? If you've got another 5 minutes or so.
Yeah. So Stratum V2 is the next generation of the mining protocol. So the original Stratum was developed by the guys that are now Brains. I believe they were Slush originally, or Slushpool. But it's a way of coordinating miners and doing the whole mining thing. It's a Bitcoin mining protocol. I actually just gave a presentation at the Atlanta Bitcoin Conference. There's a link on YouTube. I'll share that with you in our DMs so that way you can include it in the show notes. But yeah, I gave a whole presentation on Stratum V2, what it is, overview. I did a whole benchmarking experiment at work where I ran Stratum V2 alongside Stratum V1. And then I have like very objective data that shows that Stratum V2 is like better from an engineering standpoint. And then there's a whole nother, like there's just a lot of other reasons why Stratum V2 is better in my opinion. Than Stratum V1, and it's not hard to see that. But yeah, it's a mining protocol. It's a Bitcoin mining protocol, and it's the sort of the next evolution of Bitcoin mining.
Cool, gosh. And as we're bumping up to like 10 p.m. with me, I'm going to have to pull this to a close because otherwise I'm going to be awake at whatever time in the morning with babies, etc. But there's just so many cool things people are working on. Gary, thank you so much for your time, taking me through everything that we've discussed this evening, or with your morning. I hope you had your dose of Bitcoin podcasting to start the day and a nice coffee, I hope. I look forward to seeing everything you create over the months and years to come, Gary. And if you ever need anything from me, then please do reach out. But yeah, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jake. This has been a very pleasant and awesome conversation. And I look forward to seeing you around the Noster Sphere.
Thank you very much, Gary.